seven decades ago, Japanese people living in America or Americans of Japanese descent were taken from their homes, their businesses, and their families and locked up during World War II. The fear after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor was that people with ethnic ties to Japan might have allegiance to the country and could become domestic saboteurs or terrorists. We're talking about Japanese internment and the Day of Remembrance today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. What does it mean to be an American? In the 1930s, with the world in turmoil, Japanese people who had lived in the United States for decades and those who were born here as legal citizens were suddenly suspect when Japan attacked Hawaii. When the attacks reached the Aleutian Islands, Alaska natives were also taken away from their island homes and kept in camps while battles were fought over Aleutian territory. Japanese Americans saw their bank accounts seized, their assets forfeited, as they were forced to stay in the internment camps. 2016 marked the 75th anniversary of Executive Order 9066 that set the internment action in motion along the West Coast and in Alaska. One of the camps was at Fort Richardson, now J-Bear, Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Here to discuss the history of that camp, that time, and all that has come to pass since then is Morgan Blanchard. Morgan is the Senior Project Archaeologist with Northern Land Use Research Alaska. Hi, Morgan.
Hello.
Thanks so much for being here. Also on the phone with us is Marie Nash. Marie's mom was from Ugashik in Bristol Bay. Her dad was Japanese American, and when he was sent to an internment camp, her mom insisted on going with him. Marie was born in the camp. Marie, thanks so much for being on the line with us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And for those who aren't familiar with her name, Marie Nash has had an amazing career. She was the late Senator Ted Stevens' state director in his Alaska office and worked for the senator for nearly 30 years. Marie, your story has always so fascinated me. Born in an internment camp, spent your career working for one of Congress's most powerful Republicans, a man who himself was a World War II veteran. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But first, I want to invite Alaskans to join our conversation as well. Do you have family members who were interned, either as Japanese Americans or Alaska Native relatives who were Aleutian Island residents who were also sent to camps? Do you note the Day of Remembrance in your home? Give us a call. The number statewide is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Morgan, the Day of Remembrance is February 19th. That's this coming Sunday. That's the day President Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066 in 1942. It was just a little over 2 months after the Pearl Harbor attack. How quickly did the order get implemented and people started being rounded up?
Well, it depended. And actually, the interesting thing is we're celebrating 9066, but there were actually a series of executive orders that came out, some predating the actual outbreak of the war, that arranged, for example, that if the war broke out, that Japanese people or people from enemy aliens, people from states that we would go to war with, would be arrested. And then there was a series of orders that came out right at December 7th. They were actually signed on December 8th, which ordered the arrest of enemy aliens, Germans, Japanese, Italians. And then later on in February, they figured out that they decided that they wanted to create what were called military exclusion zones. And 9066, if you read it, the language doesn't say a word about Japanese. All it says is that the Secretary of War could designate military exclusion areas so that's to keep sabotage and spying down. And so it was pretty much left up to military commanders who got designated to be people that should be excluded. But there was a general policy that they aimed at the Japanese, particularly on the West Coast. And interestingly, they didn't put it into work in Hawaii, where it was a much larger population of Japanese. About 30% of the population in Hawaii at the start of the war was Japanese. But on the West Coast, they started to remove people. So, for example, in Alaska, under the original orders for enemy aliens, they started to arrest them on December 7th. They'd actually had a whole list of Japanese that had been studied by the DOJ and the FBI before the war even started. And so as soon as the bomb started to fall, they implemented the order and they arrested people on December 7th. As far as 9066 is concerned, the state of our territory of Alaska was designated a military exclusion area in late April of 1942. And by the end of May in 1942, all of the Japanese had been removed.
Really quickly, this
happened. Pretty quickly, yeah.
It didn't happen in Hawaii, where the Pearl Harbor attack took place. That seems astounding to me. What has your research shown about why that didn't go down in Hawaii?
Well, in part, it was, as I said, because of the percentage of people that were there. There were actually several policies that were going on. For example, if you were an enemy alien, there was a system where you would be arrested, held, put before a tribunal, and there would be a decision made as to whether or not you posed a threat. And they did this to Germans and Italians and other people too. But as a percentage, the Japanese were arrested at a much higher level, in part because they weren't ever allowed to become citizens. There was Japanese couldn't really become citizens until the early 1950s. So if you were a German or an Italian, you could become an American citizen, and there were a lot of them in the United States. So, but Japanese couldn't. So in Hawaii, there was a much larger population. They, if you tried to arrest and remove them all, it would have really disrupted the economy of Hawaii. And it's interesting to note that they removed everybody from the West Coast in Alaska, caused a great deal of uproar, but they had no problems whatsoever in Hawaii. They did arrest some people as enemy aliens. There is a camp that's been designated a National Historic Landmark now, Hanauliuli, that was designated, I think, last year by President Obama, that was a camp holding enemy aliens in Hawaii. But very little disruption there. So it's kind of an example that despite all of the hoopla and concern about spying, really wasn't an issue.
And also sort of a sad irony that the concern about what would happen with the economy outweighed the concern in that regard in Hawaii over fears that there might be saboteurs among the population.
Right. And it's really disturbing. You know, there are memos that exist at the highest levels where they were discussing what the actual import of removing all the Japanese from the West Coast was, from putting them in these camps. And it was recognized at the highest levels that it would have no effect on the military pursuit of the war. They didn't expect actual sabotage. They didn't expect really spying from American citizens of Japanese descent. And so the justification essentially was, number one, it would protect the Japanese because people would be so mad at them that they would hurt them. And number two, it would make them look like they were doing something useful. And that's a pretty disturbing reason to remove everybody from a single race from three states in the territory of Alaska.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the Japanese Day of Remembrance, the time during World War II when Japanese Americans were interred in camps because of fears about their allegiance to Japan. Also, Alaska Native people were taken from the Aleutian Islands and also put in camps in Southeast Alaska. Morgan Blanchard is in the studio with us, and Marie Nash is on the phone. Marie was born in a camp. Marie, where was your, when I should give the numbers again, sorry, 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. If you have family members who were interned or you have recollections of that time, 1-800-478-8255 is the number to join our conversation. In Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk at Alaska Public. So sorry, Marie. Where was your father interned, and how old were you when your family was able to leave the camp?
Well, my father was born in Hawaii and came to Alaska and married my mother, and they were out in Bristol Bay in the village of Ugashik, where he fished commercially, and he and my mom and my older brother were there at the time, and my father was moved to King Salmon first. There were some men from Dillingham that told me years later that that's where they met my dad, was in the jail in King Salmon when they were all taken there, and then, of course, transferred. I think some of them went to the J-Bear base, and then my dad went down to Minidoka, Idaho, and, of course, they were processed through Puyallup, that fairground, and horse stalls is where they were temporarily housed until they were moved on to Minidoka. And my mother went later with my older brother. She had fears in the village because people were making comments to her about my brother being of Japanese heritage, and she was very fearful. So she asked and got permission to take my brother and go down there and join up with my father. And he later joined the 442nd and went to training in Mississippi, Shelbyville, Mississippi.
How old were you? You were born there. How old were you when you left?
I was 2, and of course I don't remember anything. I did get paperwork eventually when the reparations were being considered, and the archives sent us paperwork on my family. My father was gone, of course, and what struck me as strange was that my father had to write for permission to be able to return to Alaska from the Army before he could travel with his family, with my mother and brother and me.
And when did you return to Alaska?
1945, after the war ended, and I never thought about it until years later when my sister said something like, gee, do you think mom feels uncomfortable when she goes to people's homes for tea or a visit, and they serve her tea in her own coffee cups? Because when, you know, they left the village, everything was taken, and they had no home to return to. And we stayed in this funny little house that used to belong to a family member. And the building is still standing. But after we lived there temporarily, my dad started building a new house next to it. And the nice thing is that some of the villagers assisted my family in building that new home.
You had mentioned, Marie, that your mom was concerned about your brother because of comments that people were making. It was a time of a lot of fear and suspicion. And when you came back to Alaska, you were just mentioning that people helped build a home for your family. But how was the community reception to your family when you first got there? You were quite young, but what were you told about that initial time?
We didn't know anything, and growing up, I always felt uncomfortable, like there was something wrong with me, and I never could put a finger on it. And, of course, my parents rarely talked about it, very rarely. They'd say a few things here and there and bits and pieces, and different things, like my mom would talk about my brother liking butter and how he climbed in the cupboard at the camp to eat the butter. I mean, just little anecdotal stories like that, but never anything in full detail. And it was only, I think, in high school in Haines when I was taking a history class that the history teacher mentioned the camp, and he probably knew that I was born there. I never really discussed it. I had this copy of the birth certificate, and it gave the camp address, and I never knew anything about it until about 5 years ago. I went on the Minidoka pilgrimage because I wanted to learn more about it. And I had learned some, you know, over the years in reading, and then when I lived and worked in Washington, D.C. for Senator Stevens, I went to an exhibit at the archives, and they had the executive order on display. And, of course, with this being the 75th anniversary, they were doing a special exhibit, and they've put a call out to people for various items from their years in the camp. So, yeah, when I went home, I mean, when we went home, like I say, there was hardly any discussion about it. Nobody in the village ever talked to me about it, and nobody ever said they were sorry about what happened to us and why we were singled out or anything like that. But we managed to make ourselves comfortable in the village, and it became home, you know, and my dad continued to live and work there. He did the job as postmaster in addition to fishing commercially, and he really wanted education for us, so my older brother and I were taken down to Haines, and we lived at the children's home there. There was no school in our village, but he really believed in an education, and I don't know why the villagers never asked for a school to be built there, but when kids became of school age, everybody had to leave to go somewhere else to attend school.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are talking about the Japanese Day of Remembrance, which is February 19th. My guests are Morgan Blanchard in the studio with me and Marie Nash by phone. Marie, what did you tell your children about that time, and how have they sort of processed this knowledge about their family's history and how they were treated by the United States?
Well, I only have one child, and he knows of the story through our family, of course, and various things that have been discussed and things like that. But I think it's hard for them to, and this I'm including my siblings now, it's hard for them in some ways, I think, to understand it. And I think I have more of an interest in the whole thing because I was involved, and my mom and dad and my brother are all gone now, so I've become more active in trying to get the message out, and I'm a member of the Japanese American Citizens League Alaska chapter, and I had joined the Washington, D.C. chapter when I lived there. And, of course, Senator Stevens knew of my background, and when the hearings were being held around the country, I know he held one up here, and then when the actual reparations bill was being signed by President Reagan, he invited me to go back with the Aleuts. There were about six or seven Aleut people and I. We were the only ones there. And what was interesting was that the bill was supposed to be signed in the Rose Garden. This was like in August, and it was so hot out there. We Alaskans weren't looking forward to being there, but then they told us the gardener had put fertilizer on the roses, so they moved the program inside the Interior Department auditorium, which was a lot more comfortable for us. But I thought it was going to be a little intimate ceremony with just a few people there, with the president and other dignitaries like Senator Stevens and Congressman Young and Senator Inouye and those that had co-sponsored the legislation. But it was a huge auditorium, and a lot of people were there from all across the United States, mostly Japanese Americans, I think, that were invited to see the signing. So yeah, it's been of interest mainly to me, more so. And then when they awarded the Congressional Medal to the 442nd and the MIS and the what was the third group? My mind's not thinking about it. It doesn't come to mind. But anyway, I went back there to Washington, D.C. for that as well. And they only have the one Congressional Gold Medal, but they made replicas for the rest of us. Hmm. And I think people across the country learned about it. I think there was somebody from Fairbanks that was there at the time, but there were so many people that I couldn't find anybody else from Alaska at that program.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255, or 1-800-478-TALK is the number statewide. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. You can email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. We're talking about the Japanese Day of Remembrance with Morgan Blanchard and Marie Nash by phone. Morgan, did you want to add something there?
I just wanted to give some context to what Marie said. She's mentioned the 442nd a couple of times. And the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, it was the most highly decorated unit in the history of the American Army for its unit size and length of service. They got 21 Medals of Honor over the course of World War II. They fought in some of the worst fighting in Italy. They were famous for just being an incredible unit. And they were made up of two groups. One were Japanese men from Hawaii, and the other portion of it were men from the internment camps, the sons of Japanese men who, to prove that they were good Americans, joined the military and were incredible fighters. And one of the things that we found out, and Marie knows this and other people knew it too, but it hasn't really been publicly known, is that a number of Alaskan men fought in the 442nd. And so these are, again, children of people who were being held in internment camps and joined from the camps to go and fight in World War II. So it's an amazing thing that her father was in the 442nd.
Yes. When I was reading about it, also, it sounds as if when people were in the camps, they worked really hard at having gardens and doing things to help show that they were trying to do as much as they could for the cause of the country, even though they were locked up and being held in a most unjust way.
That's true. And I have to say that there is some context here, that there are some people who felt that the best thing was to prove they were good Americans by doing exactly that. Some people felt very insulted by the fact that they were being held and not being treated in a constitutional way. And some of them are known as the no-no boys who sort of refused to swear allegiance because they felt that they were being unjustly treated. And there were also a small percentage of people who were Japanese and who supported Japan. But it's a very tiny percentage from best we can tell. And the other thing, too, is that I think that the way they were treated by the American government made, understandably, people upset with the American government. For example, some of the Japanese men who were living in the United States who had come from Japan weren't allowed to become citizens. When they were interned, they were actually interned as prisoners of war. They were kept in the same camps that Japanese prisoners brought from the Pacific battlefields to the United States to be held were treated exactly the same as them, with big P's painted on their back, the whole thing. So it was understandable that people did get upset with the government.
Marie, did you ever go through sort of a grieving process, even though you were quite young and didn't remember that time? Was there a point in your life, maybe when you were a teenager, when we're going through a lot of emotional ups and downs, that you were angry at understanding this history and at how what had happened to your family? Did you have talks with Senator Stevens about that? He was a World War II veteran. How did those things segue together, your long tenure with working with him?
Well, it wasn't until, I think after I graduated from college, I can't remember the exact time frame, but my mom and I were invited up to Fairbanks by Terry Cole and others in the community who wanted us to speak to a history class on campus. And we did that and answered a lot of questions from the students. And then there's a small little exhibit at the museum up there that Terry and others put together. And then Ron Inouye and some others had us speak downtown in the community. And I can remember, I think maybe that's when I really had like what you call the grieving process, because I can remember I was really teary-eyed about it, trying to speak about it in public when I really didn't feel like I could speak because I was too young to remember. But just the way that I felt, I think, is what was coming out at that time. And my mom answered questions as well, and I think it got to her, too, because all those years, it was all pent up. They really never felt comfortable discussing it. And like I say, just in bits and pieces around the house, we'd pick up here and there. And we never felt comfortable asking a lot of questions to learn more about what had happened to us. And I think that was why I went on this Minidoka pilgrimage. I wanted to see for myself with my own eyes. And they had one building that was returned from a farmer that had bought it. A lot of that farmland there was allowed to be bought by local farmers, but no Japanese-American farmers could purchase any of that. And they were really good farming people, as you mentioned earlier, Lori. They grew a lot of things there for a Minidoka camp, but some of the vegetables and fruits were sent to other camps. And a lot of those people from the Seattle area used to sell their produce at Pike's Place Market. They're the ones that kind of actually started that location. And some of the people from that area were able to retain their property because there were some people that were really good friends and hung on to it and paid the bills or bought it or kept an eye on it for them, whereas most people lost their property because they had to sell it at a reduced rate or it was taken over by other people while they were gone. Anyway, I think it's just been a learning process over the years for me, and looking at all these other organizations, too. And I do thank Morgan for mentioning more information on the 442nd. My dad did serve overseas in Europe, and he was wounded in battle and has a couple of Purple Hearts. And the Alaska legislature recognized him at one point years ago. And I know there's a lot more Alaskans here, and we're trying to help identify them because we'd like their history included in what we're trying to put together. And besides our local organization, the Japanese American National Museum is trying to garner information. And there's another group called the Gopher Broke that were part of the Men in Battle. And Greg Cheney did that empty chair video that has gotten more information out, and then now that movie Allegiance is being shown, and Perseverance Theater also did a play up here on, I want to say Gordon Kobayashi, was that his name? Anyway, there's many opportunities for people to learn more about it, and I appreciate all the efforts that are being undertaken and for you to recognize this special day for us, Lori.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much, Marie, for being available and being on the line with us today. We're going to go to the phones for a moment. Mary is in Washington State and is joining us. Her father was taken from Juneau. Morgan, why don't you give us a little context, and then we'll welcome Mary
sure,
with
sure.
us.
Sure, sure. Her father, Shonosuke Tanaka, ran the city diner in Juneau and was a well-known businessman there. And when he was arrested, his family was arrested later. John Tanaka is the subject of the Empty Chair Project. Mm-hmm. He was the valedictorian of Juneau High that year. And also another veteran of the 442nd. So Mary and her sister Alice came up last year, and as part of a showing here at the KSKA of the building here of the Empty Chair Project movie. But they also participated in a base ceremony out at J-Bear in a building right next to the camp where their father was held on Fort Richardson. So I'm very glad Mary's got a chance to call in.
Hello, Mary.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us.
And I'm glad to be here.
Am I understanding the history correctly? I hope I have this right, that Mary, you were born in an internment camp as well, just like Marie?
No, I was born in 1940 in Juneau, Alaska, but like Marie, I was very young when all this happened to us and was very bewildering experience.
Mm.
And like Marie, I think I'm trying to recapture what happened. You know, even though we're in our 70s now, there's been so much information that all the broken pieces are coming together.
When you talk to others about that time, how do you describe it? What are your memories of the camp?
Well, since I was just a toddler, my memories are, you know, were being very close to my mother, which was a very unique experience. But when I came back to Juneau, where my dad reopened the city cafe, I was so surprised that there were children with blonde hair and blue eyes, whereas I had grown up only with brown eyes and black hair, you know, Japanese, fully. Mm-hmm. And so for many years, I felt like a misfit because I, you know, didn't fit in. And so our family was one of only two, very few Japanese in Juneau. So it was only until I went to college that I began to feel, you know, more myself. And it took a long time to not be ashamed of being Japanese because of the war and, you know, the propaganda. And I think what really helped me was when the Civil Liberties Act was signed by President Reagan, where a letter of apology was sent to everyone who still was alive at the time. At that time, there were about 60,000 people who had been in the camp, and each of them received this letter of apology with a reparation of check of $20,000 for the injustice that had been levied against them. And I think that really helped a lot. And, you know, people started speaking up about the injustice of the act. And then I was really pleased to read Ronnie Noe's Alaska Pioneer Project, of which Marie is a part, in 1990, where people's stories were being published. And I think after that, in Alaska, Marie made mention of Greg Cheney's DVD, The Empty Chair, which told the story of Juneau's reaction of our, at the time, there were about 50 people living in Juneau who were incarcerated, which really helped also, too. And that was chaired by my class childhood friend Margie Shackelford.
Marie, that helped a lot. Mary, we need to take a quick break. I'm so sorry. We're just going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mary and Marie and Morgan as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're looking for ways to enhance your business knowledge about government contracting, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center statewide annual conference in Anchorage on March 8th. The PTAC conference presents a day of general sessions, learning labs, networking, and the popular Perfect Pitch competition. There will also be an opportunity to interact with representatives from government agencies. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the Japanese Day of Remembrance. That is February 19th, when the executive order was signed by President Roosevelt to inter Japanese Americans and people, even people that had a small amount of Japanese heritage. Is that correct, Morgan?
Yeah, it sure is. The and especially it's interesting up here in Alaska because it's a little different. Many Alaskan or many Japanese men came to Alaska as early as the 1890s, but there weren't a lot of Japanese women, and so a number of Japanese men did, like Marie's father, marry native women, and they had children who were native, raised sometimes in native villages. And so when the war came along, they went around and rounded up everybody who had a Japanese name. That's kind of how they figured out how to do it. And so you ended up with, in some cases, native peoples placed in these internment camps. And there's a well-known case where a woman said, hey, wait a minute, I'm a subject of the BIA. I'm not... You can't arrest me. You have to talk to the BIA about this. And so the Army looked it out to it and said, well, you're right. We're going to keep your husband, and we're going to keep your children because they're half Japanese, and you can either go home or stay. And so she was actually, you know, she was given this choice.
Not much of a choice.
Right. So she stayed with her children. And so in Alaska, it's very unique that way.
1-800-478-8255 is the number to call statewide. 1-800-478-8255 if your family has remembrances of internment, or you note the day on the 19th when the Day of Remembrance is. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, as Sue in Nome did. And this is a question for Marie and Mary, both joining us by phone. Marie here in Anchorage and Mary in Washington State. Sue in Nome says, I am interested to know from those who experienced internment if how they are reacting to the recent ban placed on people from specific countries. She said thank you, and she's sorry for what you have suffered. So Marie and Mary, any thoughts about what the turmoil that the country is experiencing right now?
I thought it was especially relevant because in my lifetime, there are two executive orders against people of a certain race. And so I'm totally against this new executive order, and I'm glad that the state of Washington is leading the fight against it.
All right. Thank you, Mary. And Marie, any thoughts about this?
Well, the thing that I didn't realize was still on the books is the law that allowed this to take place to begin with. I mean, I forgot what the wording is, and I don't even know the citation, but apparently it's still on the books, and that was brought out recently when some of this whole discussion was going on. I don't know if there's any effort to take that language off the books to change it. But yeah, it is very disconcerting that people are fearful because of their skin color or their religion or whatever reason they could be treated the way that Japanese Americans were treated during World War II.
Marie, you worked for one of the most powerful Republicans in congressional history, Ted Stevens, the late Ted Stevens. Did you talk about, he was a World War II veteran. Did he talk about internment era in hindsight? What was that? What did he have to say about that?
You know, I don't remember specifically, but he did have an understanding and sympathetic ear, and he co-sponsored the legislation, but after my dad died, I think it was, he wrote a really nice letter, very gracious letter, about my mom and what they had gone through. And he thought she should write a book about the experiences that they had been put through. He and Senator Inouye, like I said, were two of the ones behind that reparations bill. And he held hearings across the country because he was chair of that committee that was dealing with that bill, and he had a really good understanding of it. And like you say, he served in World War II, and so did my dad. And he had met my parents on a couple of occasions. I can remember one occasion was down in Homer. He had been invited down there to the opening of that Homer senior home or senior center. I can't remember exactly what it was called. And Gail Phillips was in the legislature then, and she met up with us. And my mom ended up showing up there, so he was happy to see her because he didn't see my parents that often. But he was very gracious, as I said, and very understanding about what people had gone through. And I think the other part for me, what was really hard, was when I was working for him, people would call in with what they called public opinion messages that, you know, they wanted to pass on to the senator. And I remember one lady calling. I forgot how come this whole thing came up at the time that she called in, and I answered the phone, and she was talking about the people being in the internment camp, and she said it was for their protection, that they had a bed, that they got fed, that they didn't have to worry about anybody being killed during the fighting. And I was trying to tell her about my experience, my family, my own personal experience, and that my dad had served in the war. And she got really upset with me, and I forgot what we said. But, I mean, I tried to not get her more upset. I was just trying to explain what I had gone through, and she got so angry with me, she hung up and then called and complained to the Washington office. And, of course, they called up to see what I was doing, and I told them, I was just trying to explain to this lady about what my family had experienced, and she got very offended.
And yet when I went back to the Minidoka camp to see it, they talk about the barbed wire fences that were up all around the camp, and they had armed guards up there watching over everybody, you know, and nobody was to escape. But on the other hand, people were trying to be as normal as possible while they were interned, and there were some teachers there, so they held classes. And like we said, people gardened if they had that ability, and other people pitched in, and some people did a lot of art. You see some of the remnants of their carvings or their paintings, and no cameras were allowed, but some of them made up a camera, and there were some photographs that they took just in the camp, and they tried to make it as normal a life as possible, I think, for the families while they were there for they didn't know how long, and then some of their loved ones were fighting overseas mm-hmm. while they were held behind barbed wire. And I don't know if all the other camps were like that. I know they have pilgrimages to the other camps, too. I think there's one in California that's been going on longer than Minidoka. Minidoka's had like 14 or 15 pilgrimages each June where people can go visit and see it for themselves and ask questions. It's run by the National Park Service, and they're making an effort to bring it back to some of the way it was. And I think they put in a ball field last summer. I didn't get to go see it, but I know one of the projects was to try to renovate that storage place for the vegetables. It's kind of still there, but the roof has fallen in, and they would like to be able to renovate that part of it, too.
Mary, thank you so much for calling in and being with us. And before we let you go, are there things that you had mentioned that you were happy Washington State is leading this effort against the current ban? And what would you want people to know about what your family experienced and how it affected your lives as you were growing up? Then we'll say goodbye and thank you so much for being with us. But what would you want people to know about the lessons from that time?
I would like to comment on the fear. My sister, who was about 12 at the time at Minidoka, said that my mother, you know, and all the women from Alaska who were mostly Issei or first generation could hardly speak English or write English, and they were left without their husbands because all the Issei men in Alaska were sent to justice camps, and that so they were separated. The fathers are separated from the mothers. And they were sent to an all-men camp at Lordsburg. And so my mother in Minidoka and all the other mothers who are Issei's were frightened. And my sister said my mother didn't know what was going to happen to us. And she became kind of irrational. She started saving bread from the mess hall and storing it under our cot. So here's an example of fear that you know, I'm sure that other you know, mothers had. And I think, you know, a mother's fear has to be somehow related to their children. And I think that's happening today with all these people who are here in our country or who have wanted to come to our country and cannot come to our country. For certain, because of the uncertainty of the Trump administration, so I just would like to focus on that, you know, the element of fear that is in our country right now. Also, I'd like to thank Morgan Blanchard because of the of the Day of Remembrance program in Anchorage. Last year, we were able to go to Fort Richardson and see where my father and other Japanese Issei were sent after they were rounded up all over Alaska. I think there were about 100 men that were sent up there. And he showed a picture of Arctic tents where our fathers were in prison. And I just thank him for bringing to light a part of our, you know, our history that we didn't know about. So thank you, Morgan.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you so much, Mary, for calling in and sharing what is clearly a heartfelt message about the history of your family and the history also of our nation and the things that have happened in the past and some of those echoes that we're seeing today.
Thank you.
This is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the Japanese Day of Remembrance. Morgan Blanchard is in the studio with us. Marie Nash is on the phone. Mary just left. She was in Washington State, and her father was also interned. Morgan, I wanted to ask about when you were researching this era, this whole topic, how was it working with the military in Alaska? Did you have any resistance or reluctance for delving into the history?
No, not at all. Not at all. The whole project kind of came about because of a survey. I'm an archaeologist, a historical archaeologist, and I was working on a project on J-Bear for transmission line. And so I was researching what was around it, and I found a 1943 map that had an inset that said internment camp. And I asked around, and nobody knew anything about it. The site wasn't listed on the Alaska Heritage Resources Survey. So it's if you look in the books, it's known. It appears in the books as a camp that it did exist. But there hadn't really been much research on it. And so I approached my company, and I approached the Army and said, hey, this is a thing. You should know about this. And they were wonderful. They actually put together some money out of an existing budget for a contract, and they funded the research to do the survey, and we were able to do the history that goes with the report that we did, and really put some names and places and dates to the Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson, or the Fort Richardson internment camp, which nobody really knew much about. And then once that came out, they put together last year a big Day of Remembrance celebration at the reserve building, which is right next to the where the camp was. And the deputy base commander came and spoke, and Mary and Alice came and spoke, and it was a wonderful day. And they've actually committed to putting together an interpretation panel to go up in that next to this parking lot to talk about the history of the camp. And so it's one of the things that we're working on, is trying to gather as much information as we can before that panel gets done, so that we have very good accurate information, that we don't leave anybody out. So that's kind of why we're doing this sort of thing and getting the word out.
Marie Nash is on the line with us, and also on the line now is Rosalie Nado. Rosalie runs the organization Aquila here in Anchorage. It's a substance abuse treatment facility. She grew up near an internment camp in Idaho. Hi, Rosalie.
Hi, how are you, Lori?
I am well. Thanks for joining us. So, Rosalie, your father was a farmer and employed Japanese Americans. Was it during the internment, or was there a work release program? How did that come about?
It started as a part of internment. There were work release programs. One of the things that the government finally discovered is that there was a lot of work needed to be done, and if they didn't get it done, with Japanese help, it wouldn't get done. And so they began to release people on furlough, sort of. They would be out for the day or sometimes a week, where they would go stay at a farmer's place and do some work and then go back to the camp. And that's how they began coming out of the camps.
What was the local community reception like?
It was... The people I knew were very friendly with and thought it was silly to have that camp. There were always people who didn't feel that way. In fact, I'm old, so I can remember back. I don't really remember the war, but I remember generally that timeline. And it couldn't have been long after the war, with a little tiny town, one little tiny grocery store, and an old man named Will Smith, ran the store. And my mom and my little sister and I were in the store getting groceries, and there was a Japanese couple leaving with the groceries they had just purchased. And as they went out the door, Will said to my mother, "I wish those Japs would go back where they belong." And my mom looked at him and said, "Where do you think they belong?"
Are you there? Rosalie? Oh, I guess we must have lost her. Well, hopefully we can get her back on the line. I wanted to ask her about a paper that she wrote in 1966 while she was in college called America's Shame, about the internment camp. So hopefully we can get her back on the line and get her on. Marie, when Marie Nash is on the line with us as well. When you're hearing those kinds of comments, what comes to your mind?
Well, like Mary was saying, you know, you're scared and you're ashamed. And I think that was part of the feeling I had growing up. And I don't know why I was feeling ashamed. I mean, it wasn't I that had anything wrong with me. You know, it was the way we were treated. And but I always felt guilty, like I had done something wrong, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's a difficult feeling when you're growing up. You don't know where you belong or where you fit in or what people are thinking of you. And because of our skin coloring or eye shape, we stand out, you know. And that's how we were easily and readily identified in many ways, too. And treated, you know, kind of like now the natives here are so readily identified. Of course, I'm a mix, but you always feel like you're easy to pick out. Mm. Because of your color and your eye shape or something. And so many laws were made back then that prohibited people. I know Japanese weren't allowed to marry Caucasians back then. I forgot when it changed, but there were so many discriminatory practices going on.
We're going to take a quick break again. Hang on with us, Marie, and we'll be back. And I think we've got Rosalie coming back on the line as well. We'll continue our conversation about the Japanese Day of Remembrance as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We just have a few minutes left, and Rosalie is back on the line with us. She grew up near an internment camp in Idaho. Rosalie, I wanted to get quickly to the paper that you wrote in 1966 when you were in college called America's Shame about the internment camp. Obviously, this part of your personal history growing up there had a big impression on you. How was your paper received? It was only a couple of decades after the war. What did people think about that?
It was interesting. It was widely received. There was a large Japanese community. I was in Ontario, Oregon, just across the river, the Snake River from Boise. And the Japanese community.
Oh, we're having phone trouble here, so not sure what's happening there, but that's unfortunate. I was hoping to have Rosalie read a part of the paper that is so reminiscent of some of the concern that people are having today about hindsight being far superior to foresight in her paper. So let's talk a little bit about some of the other camps there. Morgan, there was also a camp that Alaska Native people were taken to from the Aleutian Islands in southeast in Funtner Bay. It was, I think, an abandoned cannery. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a different experience, and I don't mean in any way to minimize it, but you know, the Fort Richardson internment camp was really like a POW camp. It had barbed wire, guard towers, light systems, the whole shooting match. What happened in the Aleutians is that there was some concern about the Japanese invasion, and so they brought people out of the Aleutians into these camps, housing for old canneries, things like that, in the southeast. And they weren't held in sort of the same conditions that the Japanese were held, but they were held in conditions of neglect. The buildings were falling down. They weren't cared for. The food supply was terrible. There was very little medical care provided for them. It was a large shift. You have people growing up in the Aleutians where it's always windy and there aren't any trees, and they're eating a traditional diet, and then they're getting shipped to this environment where it's raining a lot, bad housing, different food. And it was a pretty desperate situation. A lot of people were very sick, died, and it was a very neglectful situation. And I read somewhere that people that were being held, German prisoners of war that were being held in the area too, were treated far better than Aleutian people that were just sort of put in these camps and abandoned.
Let's go to the phones just for a moment, and then I want to give Marie a chance to have some final thoughts here before we close out today. Lowell is in Chugiak and has a recommendation on some books. Hi, Lowell.
Hi. I'd like to recommend a book named Snow Falling on Cedars, which I believe it's been a while since I've read the book. But it's
excellent book, yes.
The Washington area, beautifully written and very relevant to the show.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for that. I'm glad you brought that book up because I read that years ago, and it is an amazing write-up about that time and that era. Marie, what do you want people to remember and to think about, especially in context of what we're seeing today, about this time? What are your thoughts here in our final minute or so?
Well, I think that civil rights for people are really important, and JCL was created before all of this, and they continue to have organizations across the country, and their main one in California. But their mission of the JACL, and we have that Alaska chapter here with members that participate in various activities, but JACL is a national organization whose ongoing mission is to secure and maintain the civil rights of Japanese Americans and all others who are victimized by injustice and prejudice. And we work to promote cultural values and preserve the heritage and legacy of the Japanese American community. And we appreciate you doing this program for us, to help others remember and others to learn about it. And when we had the program at your studio last year, we had a huge turnout and unfortunately had to turn people away. But the best part was that teachers had encouraged their students, both high school and college level, to come to the program. And those are the people that we want to help participate so that the history continues and the knowledge is there so people remember what happened.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Marie, for being with us today and sharing your memories. I know Mary isn't listening now, but I wanted to say thank you to her. And Morgan, also thanks to you. Will there be, we've got about 5 minutes here or 5 seconds here, will there be something happening in Anchorage on Sunday?
Oh, yes. Well, there's a showing of a film, and unfortunately, I was hoping Marie would speak about this, but there isn't a formal Japanese Day of Remembrance ceremony this year in town.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks.
Shown, and we're hoping there to have a table there with some of our material
okay.
to share with others who attend it.
Great. Thanks so much.
Okay. Thanks, Lori.
Thanks so much to Marie Nash and to Morgan Blanchard. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening today to Talk of Alaska on the Japanese Day of Remembrance.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
The Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta Subsistence Regional Advisory Council is meeting in Bethel February 15th and 16th at the AVCP Housing Authority Conference Room from 9 to 5 to develop proposals to change federal subsistence wildlife and trapping regulations for the 2018 to 2020 regulatory years and discuss other issues related to subsistence. The public is encouraged to participate either in person or by teleconference. For all the information about the meetings, go online to doi.gov/subsistence/regions or call 800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. Contact the Office of Subsistence Management to receive meeting documents or to request special accommodation needs by 7 business days prior to the meeting. This message sponsored by the Office of Subsistence Management.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.